Hey guys, it's Jesse. Real quick, before we get today's episode started, as many of you know, we have recently announced Love Thy Neighborhood's grand finale. If you are not familiar with that big announcement, I encourage you to go back and listen. As part of that announcement, I talked about the fact that we were trying to raise $120,000 to support this grand finale. And the amazing news is this: we have actually already raised over $110,000 of that goal. So many of you made that possible through your own generosity and sacrifice. We actually only have about $8,000 left to raise, and we will be at 100%. So if you have heard this message right now, you're listening to this, and you're wondering how you can help, this is it. I mean, we are right down to the finish line. We really need a handful of folks to step up. Whether you're giving a gift of $5, $25, $100, we would be so grateful for your support. Again, we really need to reach this goal in order to make sure that we have enough time to rehome the podcast, to give severances to our staff, and to support our ministry partners one last time. The other thing is also that we are running a big sale on all of our merchandise in our store. So if you have ever wanted some different Love Thy Neighborhood stuff, whether that is Say More cards or one of our t-shirts or something else, make sure you head over to lovethyneighborhood.org and click on the store button. Everything is a sale price that we've never done before. So we could use your support. Please head over to lovethyneighborhood.org and go to the donate section to give your gift, or head over to the store and purchase something. Either one is going to help us out a lot. Okay, on to the episode.
Love Thy Neighborhood.
Okay,
oh, cool.
Oh, definitely.
Awesome. Discipleship and missions.
Mission!
For modern times.
Okay, Jesse, let me tell you about a woman named Margot.
Okay.
I edit and I'm also a ghostwriter.
Margot, she writes all sorts of things. Books, articles, she coaches other people in writing. But let's just take it back to 2014. Margot is married, she has two grown kids, she's juggling family responsibilities, all of this while meeting deadlines for freelance writing assignments. So one day she's working on a piece and she's interviewing a guy who calls himself a minimalist. And after the conversation, she gets so inspired that she decides to do this little experiment.
Ah, what kind of experiment?
Well, she decides to get rid of 1,000 items in her home.
And honestly, I understand 1,000 is a very big number.
Tell me what you think. Do you think you could do this?
I think yes. You know, we're a family of four. Self-confessed, I tend to own things. And so, yes, I think there are definitely 1,000 items in my house that I could get rid of.
I think if I got rid of 1,000 items, most of my belongings would be gone. Granted, yeah. It's just me. I'm a single person. There's no family of four here.
But you also do tend to, in general, you don't tend to purchase as many things.
Yeah, I'm a lot more frugal and like conservative with my purchasing.
Yeah.
So going back to Margot. One weekday, she sends her kids off to school, and then she rolls up her sleeves.
Pulled out bags of clothes, boxes of art supplies, opened up and pulled out all of our sporting equipment from like a trunk in the living room where we kept it. Too many bike helmets, too many skateboards, too much protective gear.
There was stuff everywhere.
And it was a big old mess. Like you could not have walked safely through our home.
And of course, there's other stuff that she's getting sentimental about.
For me, it happened like with some of the kids' t-shirts, like for this team or that church event.
And she's also wondering,
what will I have to rebuy? Like, will we find that we cannot live without a waffle maker?
Holy smokes. So how long did it take her to do this?
I go hard. And I would say, yeah, within an hour or two, like I would have pulled it all out.
Man, she's like a machine. That is actually really impressive.
You know, and as things are going to their final locations, she's still wondering, what if I'll need this waffle iron 6 months from now? What if my kids miss their extra skateboard? What if I'm going to have to buy another one of these because it turns out I'll need it again? But she gets all the way to the end, and as time passes, she's actually shocked. And the reason she's shocked is because...
The thing that I found most remarkable was that no one in our home missed the things.
You know, and this experiment wasn't the only time Margot realized she needed to do this process again. It wasn't a one-time fix.
I'm not going to say that in the last 10 years there haven't been these seasons where I've had to do, you know, round two or round three of being a better steward of some of the stuff that I'd acquired. But I will say it really did slow down what it was that we acquired.
So it's a great thing that Margot was able to slow down all the stuff that she and her family acquired. But consumerism isn't just about the material possessions that we own. It's not just asking about if our stuff does or does not spark joy. Consumerism follows us into our friendships. It follows us into our churches and even into our relationship with God.
You're listening to the Love That Neighborhood podcast. I'm Jesse Eubanks.
And I'm Anna Tran. Today's episode, where the gospel meets consumerism.
We'll be exploring the questions, what does consumerism look like in our lives? How is consumerism affecting our faith? And how can Christians fight back against consumerism? Welcome to our corner of the urban universe.
Jesse, what do you think of this statement? American consumption is part of our cultural identity.
For sure. We are consumers big time.
Yeah. To put this into perspective, the University of Michigan's Center for Sustainable Systems, they compiled this fact sheet about the U.S.'s environmental footprint. It says that the U.S. makes up 5% of the world's population, but the U.S. also consumes 16% of the world's energy. With electricity alone, the average person in the United States uses 3.5 times more electricity than the global average.
Wow.
And then it goes on to identify that since the 1970s, the average U.S. house size, it's increased by 21%. The number of occupants per house decreased 14%, and the living space per person increased 41%.
Okay, so you're talking about energy, you're talking about housing.
Mm-hmm.
How are you connecting that to consumerism?
Yeah, so all that to say, compared to the rest of the world, we have a really big appetite. And that appetite just keeps getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, that does feel true.
So just to bring some clarity, the official definition of consumerism is the belief that it is good for a society or an individual person to buy and use large quantities of goods and services.
Interesting that it's good for society. It's almost like a moral statement.
Yeah, it's like necessary, and so we must do it.
I've also heard it said that like a simple portable way of saying consumerism is like, I see, I want, I take. Whenever we see something, our instinct is instantaneous that I want to take that for myself. I want to consume it. I want to enjoy it. And that the assumption is that I should be able to. But I do think that we need to take a second and look at what Scripture says about these types of attitudes. Let's take a look at Matthew 6. So in Matthew 6, Jesus is giving his Sermon on the Mount, and at one point, he starts talking about where we store our treasures.
Yeah, I remember this. Verse 21 says, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Jesus is teaching about how fleeting it is to invest in worldly possessions in light of eternal heavenly realities.
Yes. And then what he does is he actually starts to move into the space where he starts talking about the heart and about attitudes, because he goes on in verse 24 to say, "No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." And interestingly, the word money can also be translated to possessions. So Jesus was actually warning people that trying to chase God and trying to chase possessions at the same time is an impossible thing. The reality is that you are chasing after one or you are chasing after the other.
Okay, so we hear this from Jesus, but a lot of times when we look at how we live, We see treasures not only in our homes, but in separate storage units, multiple bank accounts.
Yeah, but the thing is this, chasing possessions, it is just so normal in our society.
You make more money and you spend more money.
So this is Joshua Becker.
I am married to my lovely wife, Kim, and we have two kids, 21 and 16.
Okay, but Joshua's story actually does not start where his kids are older like they are now. It actually starts way back when they were small. So when his kids were little, Joshua was a pastor. He described his family as lower middle class. And when his small family was first sort of coming into the world, they lived in a small apartment. But naturally, like a lot of us do, as his family grew, they eventually decided they needed to do what made sense.
With each subsequent move, we upgraded the size of our home and then upgraded the number of things inside the home.
And so they did what a lot of us do. You know, they went from a small apartment to a house with three bedrooms, and then later
moved to Vermont, and that was a four-bedroom, three-bathroom.
Okay, so it is now May 2008. Joshua and his family are in Vermont, and on this one particular Saturday morning, it had really been a long winter, and he and his wife decided to do some early spring cleaning.
I woke up, I offered to clean out the garage. You know, when you live in winter, it just gets dirty and muddy over the winter.
So just imagine like your typical garage scenario. You know, you've got yard supplies and kids' toys and leftover wood and stuff for your car, and it's all just sort of shoved into this garage. And so Joshua is out there and he is totally ready to tackle this, and he's got this plan.
Let's pull everything out of the garage, we'll hose it all down, and then we'll return everything in a nice, organized fashion.
At the time, one of his kids was 5 years old, and so his five-year-old son is like, I want to help.
Which for some reason I thought he would enjoy doing. He lasted about 30 seconds until he sees his toys, and he's in the backyard.
So Joshua continues to hose everything down, he's cleaning everything. An hour goes by, then a second hour goes by. Then 3 hours into it,
I'm still working on the same garage.
Joshua's son is in the backyard begging him to come play with him.
But I just keep pushing him off. One more minute. Like, let me finish this project here.
And while all this is going on, next door, Joshua's neighbor is doing her own yard work.
And at one point, we walk past each other on the boundary line there. And she says to me, "The joys of home ownership, huh, Joshua?" And I responded by saying, well, you know what they say, the more stuff you own, the more your stuff owns you.
And then in response to that, his neighbor says something that really ends up striking him.
She says, you know, that's why my daughter is a minimalist. She keeps telling me I don't need to own all this stuff. And I stood speechless for a moment as if this was the first time in the world somebody had told me that I didn't have to try to own everything.
So his neighbor, you know, she makes the statement, she just continues about her business, but Joshua's just standing there in the driveway considering what she just said.
I looked at the pile of dirty, dusty things in my driveway, and out of the corner of my eye, I saw my five-year-old son swinging alone on the swing set in the backyard.
And Joshua suddenly realized,
not only were all the things I owned not making me happy, all the things I owned were actually taking me away from the very thing that did bring me happiness in life.
So Joshua drops everything he's doing. He immediately goes inside to find his wife.
She was, I don't know, cleaning her third bathroom of the day with my two-year-old daughter hanging on her.
And he tells his wife, like, you will not believe what our neighbor just told me. And of course, like, his wife is probably thinking it's some huge dramatic thing. And he says, she just told me we don't have to own all this stuff.
She was like, you know what? That sounds pretty good right about now.
So over the next few days, Joshua starts getting online. He's doing a bunch of research about minimalism, trying to understand it. And eventually he even decides, you know, I'm going to start a blog. He needed a place to sort of process the things that he was learning and to be able to start categorizing them and sharing those thoughts. And he begins to realize, you know, this is really going to be a long process.
If it took us 20 years to collect all this stuff, we probably weren't going to get rid of it all in one weekend.
So they come up with this plan, and it's pretty simple. They're going to go through their house room by room, and they're going to start identifying all the items that they don't need. So, example, when they were in the kitchen.
And we opened up the utensil drawer, and there were like 7 spatulas in there, different sizes and old ones that we stopped using and new ones that we had gotten for Christmas. I'm like, I don't think I've ever used more than 2 spatulas at a time.
At first he thought, hey, you know, we could just sell all this extra stuff and it'd be good for us.
We tried a garage sale and made enough money to buy pizza that night. Like, it was a total waste of time trying to sell everything.
And so he realizes, you know, that is also not what we want to do with our time, is just try to get rid of this stuff and make more money. So he actually decides, I'm going to give this stuff away to local charities. He gives stuff to pregnancy centers. He gives stuff to refugee resettlement programs. And while he's doing all of this, he can't stop asking himself, where did this come from? Like, what is the source of this problem?
Why in the world was I buying so many things that I didn't need? Why do I have closets full of stuff? Why was I living paycheck to paycheck for so many years?
And he's looking around and he just thinks to himself,
we need toys to play with our kids, but we don't need an entire room full of toys. We need Tupperware, but we don't need cabinets full of Tupperware. We need decorations in our home, but we don't need decorations just because they were on clearance at Michael's and they match the couch.
Yeah, this makes me think of marketing and sales. The point of advertising is to try to convince you that you need something that you don't have.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is this, is like marketing at its heart, its goal is make you discontent and then sell you a solution. And so if we think about this idea that like marketing is all about like make us discontent and here's the solution, really, in a lot of ways, when Joshua heard this remark from his neighbor, what he really heard in the heart of it all was, you know, there's a way to be content in life.
Where has this been my entire life? How come no one has told me about minimalism before?
And he's seeing it like revolutionary. It's like, is this the first time that this idea has ever been introduced to planet Earth? And as he's thinking it, he's like, hold on a second.
I stopped myself mid-sentence because it occurred to me that this isn't a new idea. Like, Jesus was saying the exact same thing 2,000 years ago.
Joshua said that when he read about Jesus's teaching on possessions or money,
for some reason, it seemed like, okay, Jesus wants me to live a really sacrificial, boring, crummy life today, but I'll have all these rewards in heaven.
But all those individual purchases that Joshua and his wife had made, you know, this is going to make me content. This is going to make me content. He actually began to realize the more that he gave things away and the less things he owned, he found that it was actually giving him what he really wanted, which was more time.
Less stress and more freedom and less distraction and more gratitude and more generosity and contentment and less comparison for other people.
Okay, so a couple of years go by. Joshua and his family actually moved to Arizona. He is now a pastor at a different church. But his passion for minimalism, it does not go away. You know, he actually continues to write a ton on his blog about all the things that he's learning and experiencing and how minimalism is benefiting his life so much. And so there's this one time that he wrote this blog titled, "When You're a Minimalist, But Your Partner Isn't."
It got more comments than anything else and more nice likes. And I'm like, okay, I think I'm at a point where I can stop talking about just what I'm doing and I can start sharing about what I've been learning in a way that can help others.
Joshua actually ends up doing something pretty radical. He resigns from being a pastor and decides, I am just going to write and teach on minimalism full-time as my occupation. He ends up taking all this content that he's been writing on his blog, the things he's been teaching on, and he starts putting it together, and he actually ends up putting together a book. It's a book called The More of Less. It actually goes on to become a national bestseller. And so he goes on to write a bunch more books and even now continues to speak regularly on this topic.
Okay, so does he offer any practical tips on pushing back against consumerism?
Yeah, for example, shopping. In his blog, Joshua wrote about questions to think about before you buy something. The list is really long. Let me give you three examples. Okay, tip number one, can I borrow this from someone instead of buying it?
Okay, maybe if my neighbor or someone from church already has this thing, maybe I can borrow it from them instead of buying it myself.
Totally. Good old-fashioned neighboring. You know, I had a neighbor just the other day say, can I come over and use your saw? Mm. And that's a great example of somebody going, I don't need to go spend $200 on a saw. I'll go use my neighbor's.
Right.
Okay, so tip number two, will I have to maintain it?
So extra maintenance, like if I buy this piece of clothing, is it dry clean only or can I machine wash it? If it's dry clean only, I'm going to have to invest more time, money, energy to keep it well maintained.
Yes. So if you're purchasing something, just think of how much time am I going to have to invest to take care of this thing? Okay. And then tip number three, do I own something else that can serve the same purpose?
Okay. What's an example of that though?
So imagine that you really love cooking burgers on the grill outdoors, but then you're also like, I really like also cooking burgers indoors, like if it's kind of cool outside or it's rainy. So you end up purchasing this other version of a grill that you could put on your stove. He would say, don't do that. Don't buy two things that are redundant. They're achieving the same purpose. Make the one purchase and then figure out a way to make that usable all the time.
Yeah, so maybe I put on a raincoat and grill the burgers outside. Or I have an umbrella and I'm grilling burgers outside while it's raining. I might get a little wet, but I can still grill the burgers.
Yeah, exactly. And here's the thing, like, it's easy to hear all of this and just go, oh, Joshua's just doing this because he's just sort of trying to be like an ethical social justice warrior or something. But the deal is this, like for Joshua, this minimalism, you know, this attitude of I don't want to own things that I don't have to own, that is a part of what it means for him to follow Jesus well.
For me, minimalism is about pursuing those things that matter in life and doing what I'm best at, but not for my own little kingdom, not for the sake of growing up my own little castle, but for the sake of him and his kingdom.
So when we think about consumerism, a lot of the times we just think about buying things. But the truth is, we really need to be curious about what's underneath the buying of all the things.
You mean like if folks are buying things because they're like, oh, this will lead me to happiness or stability or it'll give me purpose in life.
Right, exactly. We see, we want, and then we assume that it's ours for the taking. But what happens when we don't get what we want, especially from the church?
We would answer phone calls and emails nonstop from some parents who are just irate.
Stay with us.
Are you tired of dull, awkward conversations at the dinner table, family get-togethers, or office gatherings? Well, we can help. Check out our Say More conversation cards, your ticket to turning mundane chats into meaningful connections. With 100 thoughtfully curated questions, Say More takes the guesswork out of engaging conversations. Use it during family dinners, date nights, parties, or even in the workplace. Watch how one simple question can spark endless, enriching discussions. The deck includes lighthearted questions such as, what is your most hated chore and why? As well as, what's your all-time favorite dessert? It also includes thoughtful questions like, what aspects about faith do you find difficult? And when you meet God, what do you want to say to him? Convenient and portable, Say More is your on-the-go solution for building better relationships. To pick up your deck of Say More cards, head over to lovethyneighborhood.org and click on the store button. Again,
head over to lovethyneighborhood.org and click on the store button. Better relationships are just a question away. Get your Say More deck today and see where one good question can take you. Love Thy Neighborhood podcast, Jesse Eubanks.
Anna Tran. Today's episode, where the gospel meets consumerism.
So we've just heard from Joshua Becker, a pastor who found the joys and benefits of owning less stuff. But where we left off, Anna, you were pointing out that consumerism isn't just about having material possessions themselves. There's more to it.
Right, exactly. With consumerism, there's this underlying attitude that we deserve or we need the things that we buy. And not surprisingly, these attitudes also make their way into our churches.
If you just want to kind of do an apples to apples comparison to like what my role was within the church to a role in the corporate world, I was in middle management, but it really and truly was we're managing resources.
All right, this is Brad.
Brad McMahon.
Okay, so Brad was a student ministries pastor at a very large church for over 10 years. This church had multiple campuses, high church attendance, large budgets, and there's a lot of benefits from that. For example, Brad told me about a time when the whole student ministry group had a day of community outreach at a local park.
The city had kind of abandoned it, and really within about 4 weeks of going down on Wednesdays for a couple hours, 8 hours total, this park looked completely different. It looked like it was brand new. When we would mobilize and do stuff like that, we made a big dent.
So Brad acknowledges that there are a lot of benefits from being at a large church. But on the flip side, there are also plenty of complications. Another example, Brad told me that each summer, the student ministries team would host a Bible-focused summer camp for students at a beach. And so it's not surprising that at a large church where there would be a lot of people interested, there's also a lot of logistics. So just a quick note, this audio sounds different because it's recorded from a phone conversation I had with Brad later.
There's only so many ways you can fit 1,000 kids into buses and a hotel, and the likelihood of us doing this with 100% accuracy and making sure everybody's happy is impossible.
Which totally makes sense, but that wouldn't stop some students' parents from really sharing their honest opinions.
We would answer phone calls and emails nonstop from some parents who are just irate. If you don't get my kid in this room, they're not going.
You know, parents would name drop former pastors or threaten even to leave the church. And in response, Brad would say,
well, if we can't meet your demands and you back out, it's all right, we'll fill your spot. Like, it's not hard to find somebody that wants to go.
I mean, that makes sense to me. You know, if you've got thousands of students, like, you cannot accommodate everybody's preferences.
Right. And honestly, these types of interactions were really normal and also pretty impersonal.
A lot of those folks, you didn't ever have to worry about seeing them again, right? Because it was just a face in the crowd of thousands.
And I want to be clear, this is not, you know, trying to say that everyone from the church was like this, but it was a pretty common and real experience for Brad.
You know, I think that this story really does illustrate something that I do see a lot within the church, where we can easily view the church as a hub of services. What can this place offer me and my family? Will this music fit my taste? Will the sermon speak to me personally?
Right. I think it's just a reality that the larger a church becomes, it tends to operate more as an institution. And in the U.S., it can easily fall into these consumerist trappings, where churchgoers operate as customers and ministries are the products to fulfill us. So, as years of student ministry go by, Brad finds himself moving up in leadership. And he said that eventually he started spending 30 hours a week in meetings alone, which meant that he was spending less and less time engaging with students. And because of all of this, Brad has some thoughts that really start to trouble him.
I don't know that churches are supposed to be that big. I don't know if that's ever what Jesus had in mind.
Okay, It's 2019, and the timing of these questions also lined up with the fact that Brad and his wife sensed that their season with student ministries was over, and that actually church planting was what God had in store for their future. So it was that year when a friend of Brad's from a nearby church came to him and said,
"Hey, listen, we're searching for a new lead pastor. Would you be willing just to consult with our elders?"
The church was much smaller than what Brad was used to. You know, in total, they only had 200 to 300 people.
Here's what's crazy. Like, that is still a pretty healthy-sized church, but compared to the church he's coming from, it probably feels like, you know, minuscule.
Definitely really different. So Brad met with the elders, and as they described the type of person that they were looking for, Brad realized,
"I think the person I'm describing to you is me."
So soon enough, Brad stepped away from student ministries, all on good terms, and he became the senior pastor at this new church, which was actually only 5 miles away from the old one. So on his last day, Brad went to his office,
packed it up, loaded my truck, drove it, unloaded it in my new, all in one day.
So Brad jumps into this new role at the smaller church. One thing you need to know is that the church was in pretty rough shape, which was no surprise to Brad.
Buried in debt, behind on utility payments, behind on mortgage payments. We had to have a guarantor on our mortgage.
And because of all their debt, they were on a spending freeze. You know, Brad is really working under very different circumstances here.
The first shock was all in, all of our ministries, men's ministry, women's ministry, discipleship groups, kids, students, worship, everything in. The entire ministry operating budget was about $10,000. The joke was I spent more on pizza in student ministry than the entire ministry budget combined.
Brad said that while it was fun at first to jump into problem-solving mode and MacGyver-like ministry, eventually,
there came a point where I'm like, I'm kind of tired of this lack of perceived stability. I am worn out by the lack of perceived resource.
And on top of all of this, even though Brad is in a smaller church with less resources, he's still actually sensing pieces of consumerist attitudes in the congregation.
So it seems that consumerism is not a respecter of church sizes after all.
No. For example, one time when the church received a bunch of TVs for free, a church member, he had this idea.
"Man, we can turn this into a video wall. We can do all kinds of stuff with this. We can put this in our welcome area."
But this gave Brad pause because he was thinking about, you know, what would this communicate to the people at our church?
You were just given a bunch of flat screen TVs and you hung them up on a wall to make a giant advertisement for yourself.
Now, Brad wasn't trying to rag on his idea or anything or be dismissive. He was really trying to be sensitive to church members and visitors he was seeing coming through their doors who wouldn't be able to own these kinds of things.
There's a likelihood that we would potentially alienate folks that are living paycheck to paycheck, or folks who are on government assistance, folks who are underwater on their mortgages or their bills.
And at the end of it, they didn't end up using TVs for a video wall. They used it for something else, still in the church, but not for something flashy that people would see as soon as they walked through the doors.
It's really fascinating because I think that for many of us, if we had a whole bunch of flat screens donated, we wouldn't give it a second thought. Like, that wouldn't even be a question on the table. You know, how is this going to be perceived by the community? We would just go, looks cool, it's going to communicate the message we want to. Yeah, let's do it.
And on the opposite side, there were some folks in the congregation who were really concerned that when any type of technology got incorporated into the church space.
We had a few individuals that had some really strong feelings about, hey, I don't like the way this is going. What are we turning into here?
And these folks were just really concerned about not wanting to use the church's resources to be put towards stuff that seemed extravagant. Brad started seeing that there was a lot of friction in the church about what type of church they were going to be.
Everybody was kind of pulling in different directions. Like, well, I want this and I want that. And I want the church to be like this. And so there was not a lot of unity in terms of a shared hope and vision.
And so early on, Brad knew that he had an opportunity to change the culture of the church.
what Jesus taught his disciples is so counterintuitive, because eventually he does say, if you want to save your life, you have to lose it. Eventually he looks at him and says, you have to take up your cross and follow me.
Yeah, I mean, like everything else in life, consumerism at its heart, it is relational.
Wait, what do you mean by that?
Well, we talk about this all the time on this podcast, but this idea that all of life is about relationships. And so when we think of consumerism, you can really think of it in these two categories. There are healthy relationships and there are consumer relationships.
Okay. Tell me some of the differences.
Okay, yeah. So the focus in healthy relationships is going to be community. You know, how are you doing, Anna? What do you need in this situation? What is God calling us to? Versus a consumer relationship, it's self-oriented. It's about, how do I feel? What do I want? How do I react? How are you meeting my needs? It's very self-oriented.
Okay, so self is a part of the community. So it's not like you're saying, don't think about yourself at all.
Correct. You need to obviously think about yourself, but in consumer relationships, you think about your own needs, your own wants so much that it overshadows your ability to even see the bigger picture.
Okay, got it.
Or things like this, like in a healthy relationship, it's going to be enduring. The sense of like, I'm in this with you, we're going to stick this out, but I'm committed and we're going to endure through this together. Versus in a consumer relationship, highly conditional and momentary. You know, the moment in which you're kind of not meeting my emotional needs, you're not being the kind of friend that I want you to be, so I'm out.
So just cut the ties.
Yeah. And think about just how that is going to infect our relationship with God. You know, in a healthy relationship with God, God is valuable because of who he is. He's beautiful. He's good. He's true. But in a consumer relationship with God, God is valuable because of what he does for me. He gives me this. He gave me this thing today. He's an existential vending machine. It's about what does he produce in my life.
So I think that brings up the question, what are we going to do about this? So when we come back, we'll look at how Christians can fight back against consumerism. Stay with us.
For many young adults, you have had a blueprint provided for your entire life. You've known where you'll live, you've known where you'll go to school, what the expectations are. However, the formula that you have been following is about to come to an end. The laundry, the dishes, and the realness is all about to pile up because you are crossing the threshold into adulthood. And for a lot of you, this is terrifying. There's good news. The good news is that you're going to survive. The bad news is that you could waste precious years of your life fumbling around in the dark, unsure of what next steps to take or who to take them with. But you don't have to be confused. We've created a free resource to help you. It's called the Quarter Life Roadmap, a 5-day guide for 20-somethings to discover who you are, what you want, and where you're going. In this guide, I'm going to help you understand which stage of emerging adulthood you're in and what that means. I'm going to help you understand the traits, experiences, and support systems you already have in life, how to identify your calling and your passions, and how to build your strategy for life. And finally, I'm going to help you learn how to face your fears with the courage of Christ. This highly interactive process is customized to your life and your experiences. To get this free resource, head over to lovethyneighborhood.org and click on the free resources button. Again, head over to lovethyneighborhood.org and click on the free resources button. You're going to get access to this as well as a ton of other free resources. Listen, you don't have to wander through your 20s. You need a map to guide you. It's time to reveal what that map is. Love That Neighborhood Podcast, Jesse.
Anna, today's episode, where the gospel meets consumerism. We've been hearing stories of Christians grappling with the consumerist culture we live in, and now we want to look at this question. How can Christians fight back against consumerism?
Okay, I know that we need to finish Brad's story, but before we do that, I actually want to sidestep for just a moment because I have this really surprising thing that we discovered in the course of getting ready for this episode.
Okay, very mysterious.
Okay, so this is the story of a Christian woman who started this movement that today, right now, if you go out into the world, is one of the largest anti-consumerism movements on the planet. And the thing is this, she didn't really mean to kick off a movement of that size. But to tell the story, we actually need to go all the way back to the 1940s. Okay, so the early 1940s in the U.S., it was largely focused on World War II, and the war was really also funding our economy. So in 1945, when World War II ends, the U.S. economy suddenly needs to figure out what's next. So there's this big shift away from wartime products to home life products, stoves, refrigerators, mail order homes. Like, it's this incredible movement towards helping U.S. citizens begin to develop their home life. So that's the climate that's going on when we head into the next decade.
1950s was called the Age of Affluence.
Okay, so that's Claire Brocious. She co-wrote a piece in Christianity Today about a woman that you've probably never heard of, a woman by the name of Edna Ruth Byler. Okay, so let me paint a little picture of Edna Ruth for you. By the time that the 1950s rolled around, Edna had lived a lot of life. She had lived through the Great Depression and trying to figure out how to provide for her family amidst the Great Depression. Of course, she's living in the U.S. as World War II takes place and all the turmoil associated with that. So now, you know, she and her husband and her kids, they're trying to figure out their place in this new era of American life.
And so there was this explosion of jobs and income and variety of goods to meet demand. The 1950s was the beginning of TV advertising. Credit cards were also introduced, so the idea that you could spend beyond your means was a new thing.
So if you think of like the 1950s and you think of a woman in the 1950s, like the picture of a housewife comes to mind. But here's the thing, while Edna Ruth was a stay-at-home mom, she was a lot more than that. She was outgoing.
Something like unbounded energy. She was an excellent mobilizer and organizer. She would just see a need and then say, well, let's get to it.
Okay, so another thing to know about Edna Ruth is that she was always a part of various Mennonite communities.
All right. Yeah, so I grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. There's very large communities of Amish and Mennonite folks. They're similar, but Mennonite communities won't emphasize as much the separation from society. So they'll actually use a lot of technology. They'll wear similar clothes to you and I. But the main thing is that Mennonite people, they really want to focus on serving the community and living simply.
Yeah, and so then in light of that, it makes sense that Edna Ruth and her husband were really engaged socially. And one of the places that they would try to serve the community through was this organization called Mennonite Central Committee, MCC for short. So they were this Christian nonprofit that focused on relief and development efforts. Now, her husband actually worked for the organization, and even though Edna Ruth didn't, it doesn't mean that she was not still highly involved. For example, there was this one occasion where
she went on a trip to Puerto Rico with her husband. And that was her first international trip. And that was where she met women and became really fascinated by these embroidered linens that they were creating.
And so Edna Ruth, naturally, she starts engaging with these ladies. She sees their beautiful work that they're creating. But she also discovers something else that surprises her. They can't find anybody to sell these goods to. And so as a result,
the local markets couldn't sustain the amount of income that they needed.
And Edna Ruth, being a woman that wanted to do something when she saw problems in the world, she's like, I want to do something about this.
She said she would do what she could. She saw a need and wanted to help.
Okay, so she buys a bunch of linens from these ladies in Puerto Rico. She comes back to the United States. And then as she's talking about this whole experience with friends and other people in her community, they actually say, well, I'd love to buy some of those linens. And so she's like, okay. So she sells the linens to these folks in her community. And then she takes the money and she goes back and she actually buys more linens from the ladies in Puerto Rico. But here's the thing. She didn't end up just doing this for these ladies in Puerto Rico because she would end up traveling to,
Europe, Hong Kong, Jordan, traveled through India, with her husband.
And just to clarify, this was something that she was doing on the side. You know, it wasn't like she was trying to be a traveling salesperson. So wherever her husband's work took them, she would find opportunities to connect with local artisans who made beautiful goods. And so she'd go, she'd buy some of those goods, she'd bring it back, she'd sell those things, she'd reinvest the money, bring it back and sell them, reinvest the money. And this cycle just kept on repeating.
Okay, this is starting to sound pretty familiar. I feel like, you know, there's organizations that do some of this stuff today.
Yeah, so today we would call this the fair trade movement.
Oh, holy smokes. So she is the one who like kicked off the fair trade movement.
Yeah, but she actually never called it that. You know, she really was. She was just a woman who wanted to help other women in poverty around the globe because of her love of Jesus and because she had the ability to make a difference in an ethical way. And what she didn't realize at the time was that she was actually pioneering one of the absolute main principles of this modern day movement,
which is opening up global markets to makers and creatives in markets where the demand isn't high enough.
Okay, so then comes 1958.
Was when she and her husband bought a house and set up a shop in their basement. And so that's often the year that people say is the first fair trade store that became 10,000 Villages.
Oh, 10,000 Villages. I've definitely seen those stores around.
Yeah, I mean, throughout the 1960s, MCC started to formally support her efforts, and they folded this small basement shop actually into their organization. Claire said that it's during this time period that there's this collective awareness of two important things. So first,
means of travel and global trade.
Okay, here's what that means. The airline industry was booming at a global level. And as a result of that, if you literally look at graphs and charts, you will begin to see through the decades, especially in the 1960s, goods from around the globe start going everywhere. So this global market is expanding at really high rates. And suddenly, this country that we've never done any trade with, we actually have access to. So the first thing is all about global trade. The second thing is,
there's this growing kind of production and consumer culture happening.
So as this global economy is starting to expand all of a sudden, there's all these goods that are being made. There's also a lot of folks that are saying, man, there's an opportunity here to make a lot of money. So you could go to another country, you could set up shop, you could start making goods in a country where you could pay people a lot less money. What that means is the owner of the company is going to take home a lot more cash. But there's a whole lot of folks that are also looking at that going, wait. You shouldn't necessarily just be going to an impoverished country to make a whole bunch of money. We'd actually need to do this in a way that is fair and ethical. So there's also this growing movement around, what does it mean to pay a fair wage? What does it mean to take care of your employees? What does it mean for something to be ethically sourced? And so those attitudes are carried forward into the 1970s and 80s.
That's when there was an emergence of the, you know, International Federation of Alternative Trade, which was the precursor to the World Fair Trade Organization, the sort of formalization of the institutions we know of today.
So Edna Ruth actually passed away in 1976. And I think it's fair to say that the advancement of the Fair Trade Organization and all of the models around that, it grew way beyond what she ever could have dreamt of.
She wasn't trying to set out to influence consumer behavior. She wasn't trying to say, hey, there's this alternative to global trade. She wasn't really trying to do any of those things. If you look at the Confession of Faith for Mennonite Church, there's following Jesus above materialism, living life simply and serving others.
And so here's the amazing thing. Like, if you consider the implications of all of these things, you consider how massive, you know, the modern fair trade movement is and the push for fair wages and ethical standards and even the notion of we want to financially support people in poverty in a just way. Like, in so many ways, it can be traced back to this simple woman in the 1950s and 60s who loved Jesus and just wanted to love these women around the world.
She really was focused on loving her neighbor and her community, and was really focused on relationships she had, the local community she was a part of. She and her husband were charter members of several different churches, and so they were really about building the communities they were a part of and helping the needs as they saw them for their global neighbors as well.
Yeah, I think about how it's so easy these days to get the stuff that we want fast and cheap. But like, that all comes at a cost.
But here's the thing, a lot of times we don't even think about that cost.
Yeah, because we can so instantaneously just get what we want. It doesn't matter how much that costs if I get what I want. It's so interesting though that there's just a lot of large successful companies out there that they actually have plenty of ethical violations like forced labor, terrible working conditions for employees, not paying livable wages. Some of the companies accused of these things, some of their products are in our homes. We've used their websites. Companies like Temu, Apple, Nestle.
Okay, so you politely allowed me to interrupt Brad's story.
Yes.
Take us back. Where do we go from where we left off?
Right. So where we left off, Brad, he saw an opportunity to lead the church in pushing back against consumer Christianity. So he really wanted to see people be participants of church, not just consumers of church. And so one practical way that he does this is with just a slight shift in language.
If you want to join our church, you're not a member because we're not a country club. You're a partner. And so the expectation is you should expect us to walk with you and help you develop in your discipleship. Our expectation is for you to jump in and help us do ministry.
So this may seem like semantics, but Brad, he decided to change the language around church membership. And so people who join the church, if they're really serious about wanting to be a part of this church, they're not called church members, they're called church partners. And so this is just a subtle way he wants to frame how people interact and engage with church. Brad wanted to lead the congregation to be more in line with what he saw in Scripture.
Jesus says, like, I want you to produce fruit, not just fruit, but more fruit, not just more fruit, but much fruit.
So that's a lot of fruit there, right? So,
yeah.
You know, when we go to church, we're not just taking in the fruit that other people are trying to give out. We do have a responsibility to produce. It's something that Jesus talks about. And of course, change like that doesn't happen overnight. But Brad told me that he is actually seeing something beautiful happening right now in his congregation. After many years of teaching on the importance of ministry participation, recently, when he asked people from his church what they hope the church will look like in the future, here's what they said.
3 years from now, we hope that crime in our community is going down because we're meeting needs that aren't being met. We want to see the divorce rate drop. We want to see the percentage of families living on government assistance go down.
And the thing is that Brad is seeing a shift. A shift in people caring more about what they can give versus about what they can get. They're caring about things like justice, about caring for the poor, making disciples, taking care of each other. And Brad pointed out that just because there is a perceived lack of resources, that doesn't mean a church cannot be fruitful producers.
Instead of looking at what you don't have or the lack of resources or lack of funding to be able to buy this, that, or the other that you think will make it possible to do X, Y, or Z, just get on mission and let Jesus take care of stuff.
So, of course, the question is, what do we do with all of this? And what are the implications of the good news of Jesus and the gospel on this issue of consumerism? It's really easy to get to this point in a conversation like this and to think, I shouldn't be a consumer. But God made us to be consumers. We are dependent people who need things. And we don't just need just water and just bread. God gives us a lot of really beautiful, good gifts in life because he's just a loving father. There are some things that are just created for joy and pleasure, and we should be able to enjoy those things. But here's the deal. At its heart, consumerism is a relational issue. Relationships with the products and services that we buy, relationships with people, relationship with God. Consumerism turns these relationships into transactions. And in these transactions, we feel like we always have to come out net positive. And if there's any situation in which we're coming out net negative, that is not tolerable, and that's not how things are supposed to be. But God's kingdom is different than that. Because here's the deal. When we are citizens of God's kingdom, we live in a state of net positive because of all that Jesus has done for us, because of who we are to God, how important we are to him.
And that puts us in a place where we don't have to have just purely transactional relationships with people and things, because God abundantly provides for us. And it doesn't mean that there's not a whole lot of gray that we're going to have to navigate on this issue of consumerism. Should I buy this or not buy this? What is the nature of a healthy relationship with this person or that person? That's not what we're saying. What we're saying is this: we don't always need to look out for number one, ourselves, because God's looking out for us, and we can trust him. And that puts us in a place to be able to give generously and freely with less strings attached.
Psalm 24 starts off with, "The earth belongs to the Lord, and everything in it, and everyone who lives on it, it all belongs to him." Why? Because he founded it. And so you realize, like, everything that I have has all been entrusted to me by God to use it in the way that ultimately he directs, as he would. You are an owner of nothing. You're a steward of everything. If you can get that right, then things like giving and generosity and all that stuff come along with it. If you see it as yours, you're going to treat it as yours. But if you see it as, this all belongs to Jesus, he's entrusted me with it for whatever reason, and so I'm going to do the things that he would do with it like he would.
Special thanks to our interviewees, Joshua Becker, Brad McMahon, and Claire Brocious. Listen, you can check out Joshua Becker's writing on minimalism by going to becomingminimalist.com. You can also check out Brad McMahon's sermons by heading over to adventureky.org. If you'd like to read Claire Brocious's original article about Edna Ruth Byler, head over to christianitytoday.com. To hear one of our other episodes related to the topic of money and possessions, check out our episode number 17, Where the Gospel Meets Wealth.
Senior producer and host is Jesse Eubanks. Co-host is me, Anna Tran.
Anna Tran is our producer and audio editor who, the other day, when she was describing the kind of person that would be Katy Perry's backup shark dancer, realized,
I think the person I'm describing to you is me.
Music is from Lee Rosevere, Poddington Bear, Blue Dot Sessions, and Murphy DX.
Listen, if you have not already left a review for this podcast, please do so wherever it is that you listen to podcasts. It helps people find this show. It means a lot to us, and it also really encourages us. So make sure you look up Love Thy Neighborhood on whatever podcast app you're on. Leave us a review.
This show is brought to you by Love Thy Neighborhood. If you want a hands-on experience of missions in our modern times, come serve with Love Thy Neighborhood. Love Thy Neighborhood offers summer and year-long missions internships for young adults ages 18 to 30. Bring social change with the gospel by working with an innovative nonprofit and serving your urban neighbors.
Experience community like never before as you live and do ministry with other Christian young adults. Grow in your faith by walking in the life and lifestyle of Jesus and being part of a vibrant, healthy church. Apply now at lovethyneighborhood.org. Which of these was a neighbor to the man in need? The one who showed mercy. Jesus tells us, go and do likewise.